Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
I'm David Goldstein. The date is Monday, November 15, 2021. A lot of the leaves have fallen off the trees at this point. Fall foliage is past peak. Thanksgiving is coming up. Before you stuff yourself with turkey and watch the Detroit Lions lose and pass it on the couch, you get to listen to an episode of The Drop.
Happy Monday, indeed. Hope you are all doing well out there in Dropland. As Dave noted, I was driving around today, driving my kids to school, and thinking, the first thought that came to my mind is, man, it just looks like November right now. There's still leaves on the ground. There's still a few trees that have some leaves on them, but everything has turned from that bright red, that bright yellow, that bright orange to kind of a shade of brown. And it's a time of year as a kid, I didn't appreciate this. I don't know about you. I did not like November as a kid. It just felt like an onset of winter. And now I've really come to appreciate the natural annual dying process that we go through with nature, where everything kind of returns to the earth. It gets really cold. It gets kind of dark. We know that we're in for 3 months of a chill. We're going to be inside for a bit of time. The music is going to change. We're going to start making things like soup and roasting meats. We got the holidays around the corner. New Year's is around the corner. And unless there's something shocking coming around the corner like there was 2 years ago at this time, I feel pretty good going into the winter, into the spring. How do you feel about this all, Dave?
Yeah, I like November. Thanksgiving's probably my favorite non-denominational American holiday. So I'm looking forward to spending some time with my folks. I'm in a good mood because my oldest daughter, my seven-year-old, got her first shot of the COVID vaccination on Monday. It was really easy because they actually did it in the gym of her school. So we literally showed up. She came downstairs. We did a registration on an iPad. My wife held her close because she was a little bit terrified, but she got that shot. And that's great. She'll get another one, I think probably right after Thanksgiving. And that's good. There's one way we'll come out of this thing, or at the least get it a little bit closer to being endemic, is getting our children vaccinated because they happen to be carriers and vectors of COVID. I believe in science. My daughter believes in science. I was happy that New York City seems to be taking this thing seriously with regards to the kids age 5 and 11. So that was good.
I love it. Yeah, my son is scheduled here for the next week. Really, really excited for him to be able to get his. I'm getting a booster. I think the date that this episode drops, I had to lie a little bit on my application to get a booster shot. They ask you if you live in a area that has high COVID risk. And my initial answer was no, because I don't. And they said, sorry, we're holding these for vulnerable populations. And I was like, you know what? I played by the rules with the original shots. I waited. I did everything I needed to do. I let the old people get it. I let everyone who needed the shot before me, because I figured I've been in my house for 12 months. I can stay in my house for a couple more months. This is okay. And then I went back and I said, screw it. I do live in a place where there is high COVID risk. You know why? Because I have unvaccinated kids right now, and COVID is absolutely raging in Colorado, and I like seeing live music, and I want to see more live music. Please take this question out of the application. Anyone who wants to get a booster shot right now should be getting a booster shot if they're past 6 months of their last shot. Am I wrong?
No, I think it's actually trending in that direction. I know when I filled it out, I think the question was 18 to 49 and like a high risk environment. And yeah, like you said, I have two young kids that at the time I got my booster, they were both completely unvaccinated. My 2.5-year-old is still unvaccinated, going to a daycare, people that are unvaccinated. And judging from the fact that I was the only person there getting my booster, people aren't banging on the door to get them. And they should be.
Beyond the state of the world, what else is happening? What else is going on in the news musically right now?
Want to send us some well wishes to Chuck Garvey from Mo, one of the guitarists. It was noted from the band that he suffered a stroke over this past weekend. I think I'm hearing he's in stable condition. Obviously, Mo's a very, very good jam band. They've been doing it great forever, and Chuck is one of the nicest guys in the game, so we want him to get as healthy as soon as possible so we can see him back up on stage shredding 32 Things and Meat and Waiting for the Punchline and all those great Mo songs. So get well soon, Chuck.
Yeah, I saw Mo. This is going to shock a lot of our listeners. Maybe it won't. I saw Mo for the first time in June 2019, and it was a fantastic show. They just know what they're doing, and like an incredible mixture of where are we at in this song jams and great early 90s, mid-90s jam band songwriting. I absolutely loved it. So huge thoughts, huge well wishes to Chuck Garvey.
Yeah, their albums, the 90s records, jam bands aren't generally thought of making great records, but Tin Cans and Car Tires and Dither and even Wormwood are three of like the best sounding, best written jam band records ever. So yeah, please get what you got to get, Chuck, and seriously get back out there.
So in addition to this sad news, there is news of, I don't know if I would say one of our favorite bands, one of my favorite bands the last 15 years is putting out a new album, Beach House. And I shouldn't say that they're putting out a new album, because they're putting out what appears to be four EPs, all contained within a double LP, 18 songs off of an album called Once Twice Melody. Will be released in, quote, chapters over the course of the next 14 months. There is a song on here called Pink Funeral, which, as Dave noted in our notes, is the most Beach House-y track title ever, and I think I would agree with you. Four tracks just dropped right before we recorded here. We both listened. They sound kind of what you would imagine as a step forward from Seven. There's a little bit more space. There's a little bit more atmosphere. Very, very, very Beach House-y. I dig the sounds. I dig the songs. But I have thoughts on this rollout. Dave, I'm going to throw it to you. What are your initial thoughts as someone who doesn't absolutely love Beach House? What are your thoughts on the rollout here?
I like the last Beach House record a lot. Was that Seven? That's the last one?
That was the one that came out in 2018. I loved it. That was my number one record at the halfway point of the year.
Yeah, Seven's great. Teen Dream's great. And Bloom is very good. Those are the three Beach House records I tend to fuck with the most.
Teen Dream is like one of the best records of the last 15 years, I would argue, but carry on.
I don't know. I mean, my feeling about album releases is has always been just give me the fucking record. Just like put it out there, drop it, give me everything so I can sit there and just listen to it all at once. Putting out four songs and chapters from February, from November to the end of February, it's kind of, I know Beach House are artists, but just give me the record. I don't have time to like stay up to date on like every four Beach House songs that come out. It's, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the one hand, like we've got to, artists have to figure out a way to stay creative and relevant in terms of like where we're at in our lives. And they have to like kind of meet us, but also challenge us. I think that's part of like the joy and the pleasure of following artists is that they figure out new ways to have you listen to their music and consume their music. And I think, you know, for our, what it's worth, one of our favorite bands, Phish, is a great band in terms of challenging the way that you're consuming art. Think about their most recent Halloween album that put people in a position to reinterpret and reimagine the band all over again through an immediate live album drop. That said, I tend to reside more in the camp that you're at, and this kind of preludes a discussion that we've been tossing around via text messages that I think that we'll have either towards the end of this year or early 2022. Being young dads who have limited time but really, really love exploring and discovering new music, the challenge of not having music just like delivered to us and delivered to us in a way that says, hey, this is what I am. This is what you're going to get out of me. Listen or don't listen. And I feel like part of this is just catering to a listener base that in 10, 15 years, maybe even 5 years of consuming this in a really positive manner and in an invested manner will just not be invested. And as a result, it feels more like a gimmick than it feels like an actual album release that needs to be appreciated and taken. Like ultimately the music is going to speak for itself.
Right. But if my feeling is if all the songs are made kind of at the same time in the name of one record, and if you listen to the four songs and you enjoy them, and you want to hear more, it's obnoxious knowing that everything's already out there, it's already done, and then you have to wait another month and wait another month.
Right.
I know Bell and Sebastian did, one of my favorite bands, did something similar. I think like their last release wasn't so much an album as it was three separate five-song EPs that once they were all out, they kind of just like threw them together in a playlist for it, even though it wasn't ever designed to be a full record so much as like three EPs. Sort of with Bell and Sebastian, they've kind of progressed from being like a very Nick Drake, I hesitate to use the word fae, but that's kind of early Bell and Sebastian, whereas more recently they've kind of just been like a great Northern Soul rock and pop orchestra. So the three EPs kind of made a little more sense than it seems to make here. Maybe we're just dwelling on this too much. Maybe we're just being selfish, wanting to hear more Beach House. I don't know, but immediately when I first saw that, my mind didn't go to, oh, great, new Beach House record. It went to, oh, that's dumb. So.
Mine too. And ultimately, it's just give me the record because, like I said, the music is going to speak for itself. Regardless when a song comes out versus when another set of songs came out, the strong elements, the thematic elements are all going to speak for themselves. And the idea of consuming four songs and then another four songs and figuring out where those four songs fit with the previous four songs and then the next four songs, I don't know, it just feels like, just feels unnecessary.
It was also kind of the problem with, not the most recent War on Drugs record, but the previous one, A Deeper Understanding. They put out so many singles that by the time the record came out, you already heard half the album. I don't know, maybe it's a more interesting discussion, more interesting ways to put out records, but I tend to think Sturgill Simpson said it best when he put out his album Sound and Fury a few years ago. I don't even think that had a pre-release single. Maybe it had one, but he just kind of dropped the record and did the whole rollout at once, and he said it's not like the 90s where there was two singles and a whole bunch of fill and run up. The kids don't want that anymore. They just want your fucking album. And Sturgill is usually right, and he was right there.
Yeah.
Like his last album, The Ballad of Dude Wanting, that didn't have any pre-release single. That just came out. It's like, here.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that's the thing at the heart of it is, you know, there's so much noise right now, and there's so many different competing ideas in music that I get the creativity and I get the desire to say, hear us in a new and unique way. But I tend to agree with Sergil. I just want the fucking record.
Just want to say, why don't you tell me the name of the movie that you want to see?
That is a surprisingly great segue that I don't even think that you made into our next topic, which is NBA chatter, because Kramer jokes from New York City in the 1990s just harken back to Michael Jordan, the guy. So we are about a month into the 2021-22 NBA season, which continues to be the most incredible season for both Dave and I for the first time since, probably, when was the last time the Bulls and Knicks were in the playoffs together? I want to say it was the 2013 playoffs when the Knicks had one of my favorite teams, a prelude to the three heavy teams of the 2010s. You know, you had J.R. Smith, Carmelo Anthony, I think, was Chauncey Billups on that team? No, Jason Kidd was on that team.
Yeah, no, Jason Kidd was on that team. Melo, I think Amari might have been on that team at that point.
Amari was still on the team, but he was pretty injured at that point in time.
Right.
It was an incredible Knicks team. That was one of my favorite Bulls teams. That was my second favorite Bulls team ever. But we are here a month into the NBA season. How are you feeling about your New York Knickerbockers?
I feel good. They're 7-4. At this time last year, they were 5-6. There's been, you know, Knicks fans, especially in New York, Knicks pundits always look to make, you know, excuses, or not so much excuses, or they're really hesitant to get their hopes up too much. Like the Knicks just beat the Sixers, who were 8-2. That was the most recent win. They said, okay, well, that team didn't have Joel Embiid. It didn't have Ben Simmons. These guys were hurt. A win's a win. Like, you know, they still, they kind of had to turn on like in the fourth quarter. It wasn't the Sixers at full, you know, at full capacity. But look, they're 7-4. People are always going to complain about Tom Thibodeau's rotations, but people just like to complain. I still think it's a really fun, exciting team with both veteran leadership and young role players. So I'm feeling good. Tonight will be a big test. They play the Bucks again after they destroyed them the first time out. We'll see how they do tonight.
That'll be a big game. Bulls have a big game tonight against the Dallas Mavericks. Bulls and Mavericks are both currently 7-3. Bulls are second in the East. Mavericks are third in the East. We both understand we're 10 games into the season. That's very difficult to compare standings right now. But just for the purposes of the pod, Bulls are second in the East. Knicks are sixth in the East, separated by one game. Both have the exact same amount of wins. I'm right there with you, man. We had our biggest win since the Obama era on Monday evening. We beat the Brooklyn Nets at home in an incredibly dominant performance. I was completely shocked. Game was tight through the first half. Game was tight into the third quarter, and then the Bulls went on a run, and our rookie, Ayo Dosunmu, and our new pickup, DeMar DeRozan, both were phenomenal throughout the fourth quarter. Nikola Vucevic, who we traded for at the trade deadline last year, had an incredible fourth. Looks like he woke up in a lot of cases. And Zach LaVine didn't screw it up at the end. So it was an amazing fourth quarter. We won by 23 points against the Brooklyn Nets. Granted, they don't have Kyrie Irving, but James Harden and Kevin Durant on your team is about as close to a super team as you could get. So tonight we play the Mavericks, and then we start a huge West Coast road trip that begins with a Friday night ESPN game in San Francisco against the 9-1 Golden State Warriors. We play the Warriors, Blazers, Clippers, Lakers, Nuggets, all at home. There's going to be we'll have a very clear sense of who this team is when we come out of this upcoming West Coast road trip and how realistic the joy of the early season is. So I'm excited right now, but we'll see.
I should probably go to a Nets game because I like basketball enough to appreciate James Harden and Kevin Durant, and I could find Nets tickets on StubHub for like $25, whereas the Knicks, if I want to go, I have to take out a second mortgage on my apartment. But now the Nets, they've got great players, they're a great team, and yet no one really seems to care. I don't know. I should go. Barclays is not hard to get to.
It's a really and it'll be interesting to talk about it as like this is the second straight season of very high quality Nets basketball. But it's a really challenging thing to consider. Like when the Mets came to New York and kind of tried to pick up the ashes of the Dodgers and the Giants, everything that I've read is that there were a number of Yankees fans as well as post Dodgers Giants fans who became Mets fans because the Mets were fun, the Yankees were too serious, the Yankees were too button up, the Yankees just won, there wasn't fun baseball, and the Nets have kind of tried to take the Yankees approach of saying, hey, New Yorkers, you've been dealing with a dysfunctional team for the last 2.5 decades, come to us where we promise that we're going to win, and they don't seem to really have attracted the culture, whereas like the Knicks are this scrappy underdog team that everybody just falls in love with.
Difference between the Mets and the Nets is that, I mean, the Mets, like you said, from the ashes of the fan base of the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers. But, you know, when the Mets came, they gave them a brand new, I mean, Shea, they were playing in the Polo Grounds at first, but 1964, I mean, Shea was very state-of-the-art at the time. And also, I mean, look, the Nets are playing across the river in New Jersey forever. So people are like, all right, this is still, I mean, most people still think of them as the New Jersey Nets playing at the Izod Center in the Meadowlands next to MetLife. You know, plus, it's just the Knicks. I mean, it's just a Knicks town. When the Knicks, if the Knicks get to the playoffs and advance in the playoffs, I just can't wait to see the amount of, like, chaos that's going to result from being around the Garden, because New York will never be as enjoyable as when the New York Knicks are playing very well.
Dude, there was that game last year in the playoffs. It was, you know, for the majority of the NBA season, there were no fans in the stadium. And then they started to let fans back in May.
That was awesome.
And the Knicks played the Hawks in MSG on like a Sunday afternoon. It was a close game. I believe it was Rose who hit a huge shot with like 25 seconds left, something like that. Maybe it was Julius Randle. And there was this explosion of energy in MSG. And I remember watching on the TV and just being like, I have not seen this since February 2020. And I had forgotten what it looked like to see 18,000 people in a room together celebrating and hugging. And it was like, nothing could have beaten that moment right then and there. It was incredible. All right, so before we get into the big discussion of the week, we want to do as we do every week, recommend to you podcasts from Osiris Media that we have been enjoying and that we recommend you listen to as well. David, what do you have on tap for us here from Osiris?
One that I recently enjoyed was, of course, the podcast Comes a Time with Mike Fenoya and Util Burbridge. They always have a very interesting guest. They always get good things out of them. And one of the most recent podcasts, they had Jim Belushi on. So, of course, I mean, most people know Jim Belushi as, you know, the brother of John Belushi, long-running comedian, actor, sitcom dad, had a cord in the gym forever, kind of a, you know, lovable goofball, Midwestern goofball type. But he's actually been in the news lately more so for having a very large commercial cannabis growing operation in Oregon. I think he has his own podcast about it, and he's kind of become an evangelist for the healing power of cannabis more recently, which is, I think, probably one of the reasons that they wanted to have him on Comes a Time. And it was just a very interesting conversation, kind of hearing how he got into the cannabis game, how it's affected his life, how it's changed the lives of his customers. I think especially he's looking to help the lives of soldiers with some PTSD and kind of really getting down into the nitty-gritty of the healing properties of such. But, you know, also it's kind of it's a heartfelt convo. I think even at one point when he talks about how like a soldier came up to him and said, you know, one of your strange is kind of the only thing that's helped me get over what I've seen in Iraq. He almost breaks into tears at one point. But, you know, just interesting conversation among a fellow comedian and Mike Fenoy, and of course, Utile being the incredible bass player, musician that he is. So I think that one was a pleasant surprise. I would highly recommend checking it out.
Yeah, they do amazing work over there at Comes a Time. I love that podcast and the conversations that they get in around both music as well as around kind of lifestyle and positive lifestyle, you know, positive ways to live and exist is just fascinating. I'm going to recommend a episode from the Jambase podcast. Our media partners at Jambase run a phenomenal podcast and hosted by a variety of voices, but this one was hosted by Dave Onigman, who we talked with, I want to say back in April, about the Clusterflies release, which was an incredible compilation of indie jam artists playing Fish tracks from the Farmhouse era. Definitely go back and check that out. We released it, I think, under the Undermine feed. So check that out. Really, really great conversation. Dave is kind of one of my favorite people to hear about and talk about music with. He has a really, just really cool, like, fan-oriented perspective, but also like the questions that he asks within interviews just drive his topics and his interviewees in a really fascinating way. So he spoke with Brad Barr, who is one of the lead songwriters of both The Slip as well as the Barr Brothers. And they spoke mainly about the return of The Slip. The band is coming back. They've played scattered shows. They played like at Lock-In earlier in the year. They played at the Jambase 20th anniversary a couple of years ago, but pretty much been radio silence from The Slip since the mid-2000s, as the Barr Brothers have been the main focus of Brad and Andrew Barr. They are now back together as The Slip, as a trio. You know, back when I was first getting into jam bands and was first getting into Fish and the Grateful Dead, I went and saw Vita Blue in the summer of 2002 at the Vic Theater in Chicago, Illinois, one of my favorite places to see music ever. And the opening band was a band called The Slip, and I'd never heard of them, and they blew me away. I bought their record that day. Angels Come on Time was the record that had just come out. Ended up talking with Brad Barr after the show, and he just seemed like a really cool, really genuine, thoughtful guy. And I followed them from there on out. Some of my best friends I made at college were all based around listening to Angels Come on Time and From the Get-Go, Live at Lupo's, the Alive Electric, Alive Acoustic albums that came out. My wife and I, when we first started dating, one of the things that just like made us absolutely connect with each other was our love for The Slip. The album Eisenhower came out in 2006 and was just like a huge, huge record for me at the time. I was 21 years old. Like I said, me and all my friends in college were listening to these records on just repeat. And then they just went away. And now they're back. And it was a really cool conversation to hear where Brad's mind is as he's restarting this project that, you know, really got him into the music industry and got him to a place where he could play music professionally for the rest of his life and his entire career. It could be his job. They talk about the jazz scenes that had emerged in Boston and New York that kind of fused with the jam band world in the mid to late 1990s, playing festivals, writing songs, kind of the development and the evolution of The Slip, where certain Slip songs that were written in like 05, 06, 07, how those became Barr Brothers songs and which of those may come back into the Slip's lineup. And he said something that I'm going to paraphrase that I just absolutely loved. It kind of relates to ways that kind of Trey Anastasio talks about music, that when you walk on stage, grace is always present, but it's whether or not I pass through it and whether or not I embrace it. And this idea that like when you walk on stage to play music, there's always that energy that is capable of being reached. It's whether or not you can, as the individual, can surrender to it or can embrace it. And I absolutely loved that. It really just fits the music that Brad Barr has played throughout his career. So Jam Bass podcast, The Slips, Brad Barr, highly recommend it, as well as Comes a Time with Jim Belushi. And with that, we're going to get to the big topic of the week. All right. So, as we always do, we have the big topic, big discussion of the week here to make up the meat of the show. We've been kind of throwing around this idea for a couple months now, and Dave finally suggested it. I'm really, really excited about this. This is going to be a fun discussion. We went back to the Billboard charts and pulled out the top five songs on the Billboard charts from the week that we were born. And we've listened through these, and we're going to talk about them, and they are kind of fascinating. I'm really excited for this. I was listening through these last night at dinner with my wife and kids, and listening to Dave and I are 6 years, 5.5 years apart age-wise. And so you hear this like really cool evolution of music between the week that Dave was born and the week that I was born. And we're going to go through this because there's some jammers in here, and there's some songs that they explain a lot about, I think, where we are both musically and at life. So Dave, you were born on September 24th, 1979. I'm in awe of the fact that you can say you're a child of the 70s, like just barely. What were the top five songs of the week, and what were your thoughts on these?
Okay. Number one song was The Knack, My Sharona. Kind of, it's a pretty rock and roll song that a lot of people are familiar with. I think it was on the Reality Bites soundtrack.
Possibly. I mean, that's a song that like, when I listened to it, I had a very specific idea of what that song was just based around the chorus. And I don't think I'd actually ever listened to the entire song in full. And I'm, as with much of your list, I'm kind of shocked that it was a number one song on the radio.
Yeah.
It's got a chorus that like everybody knows.
Yeah. I mean, it was big enough for Weird Al Yankovic to parody with the song, My Bologna, of course. It's a little, the problem is if you go back and read the story about the song, like Sharona's a real person. She actually exists. I think I read that she might be like a realtor out in California now. But at the time of the song, it was basically the dude from The Knack lusting after a teenager, which it's a horny song and it's a little bit gross, but it rocks.
It's a gross song when you know what it's about.
Yeah.
The thing that shook me was it has a legitimately great guitar solo that lasts about 15, 20 seconds longer than it should in a pop song that reached number one on the Billboard charts, and like blew me away. Like the last part of it, my wife and I were listening to it, and we were like, I don't think I've ever listened to this song in full, and I cannot believe that this actually has this incredible of a guitar solo. It just doesn't fit, but it's amazing.
One hit wonder was The Knack, but I think maybe one of them, I don't think they were the first new wave band to get the high up the charts. You know, Blondie had some big chart hits. I think the song might have been produced by one of Blondie's producers. At any rate, I was definitely pretty familiar with the song before seeing where it was on the Billboard charts, which I cannot say for number two, a guy named Robert John, song called Sad Eyes. Actually, this is one of the songs I said, I don't know what the hell that is. And I listened to it and I heard the chorus. I said, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, that song. So this is a song where Mr. Robert John, he sings in falsetto, and then it just gets the chorus, sad eyes. I think like there's like some infidelity issues, but he's willing to take back the philander. I don't know. I heard this song, and I thought that this was, I could imagine like, if there was like a Will Ferrell or like an Adam Sandler movie and like Will Ferrell just like sobbing along to the song in kind of like a so bad it's good ironic manner, or I could see it being used in like a South Park scene where, you know, Stan pines for lost love just because it's kind of one of those so not good, it's good.
Yeah, this, again, and I felt this through a lot of your top five lists. Like, I feel like when we get to my top five, it makes a lot of sense that these are top five hit singles. Your top five list, I was like, wow, it is amazing what was possible in the 1970s with art and popular culture. And this song felt like it could have come out of like the 1950s in a lot of cases. Like it just, it was a sad crooner that did not feel a part of its time, but also like the gloss on the backing instruments just worked perfectly.
I think there's, he did a recording of The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which was a hit for him in like a few years prior to this. But yeah, this is definitely like a yacht. I don't know if it's on the boat. It's kind of yacht rock. It's kind of yacht. It's almost like more, almost like a doo-wop, but
he's singing from the dock.
Yeah, singing from the dock. Nobody hears about this song anymore. This song really didn't like stand the test of time, I don't think.
So your number three is the most perplexing pick on here that has a lineage to later pop success, but just blew me away on first listen. A 7-minute instrumental jam, Herb Alpert's Rise. Tell me more.
Herb Alpert's Rise. Man, you listen to this song, you put on your leisure suit, you hit the town, and you do the fattest rail of coke that you've ever seen. You throw your head back and go, wow. This song, it's just like, it's like a soundtrack to, you see like the drug kingpin's boat docked to Miami. But in terms of lineage, the bass line, you hear the bass line and think, where have I heard that bass line before? Where have I heard that before? Oh, yeah. And the posthumous Biggie Smalls hit Hypnotize. The producers, they took the bass line, they slowed it down a tad, maybe lowered it, but that is the Hypnotize bass line. But yeah, this is, I think the idea of the song was they wanted, initially it was going to be disco, but then Herb Alpert's like, well, you know, don't make it quite disco. Slow it down to give kind of like a more slow, sensual song for the end of the night.
Yeah, it just feels like the late 70s. I can see the like the red drapes. I can see kind of the glass table. And I just felt cool listening to it. And I was just like, I was blown away again. Like the ability for popular culture to embrace a 7-minute instrumental track in the late 1970s, I've often thought I should have been, you know, in my 20s and 30s in the 60s and 70s. Just feels right in terms of my personality. And hearing a track like this, I was like, speaking my language, man. I love this.
Yeah, has a lot of the feel of some of the early 1970s CTI stuff, the Creed Taylor International label that had a lot of like jazz fusion and congas and stuff like that. This is a bit later because it's 79, but definitely if you enjoy Deodato, you'll enjoy this song and the whole album that it's off of. I think the album is called Rise as well. It was, it's definitely of a time. Now, number four is a song that I'm guessing listeners probably know very well. I know very well. Michael Jackson, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough. Just an incredible groove, incredible Quincy Jones. This was the first, the opening track off of the Off the Wall LP. I mean, a song like this is so amazingly good that when you think when people try to compartmentalize this era of Michael Jackson versus the monster that he became, you begin to say, all right, if I don't want to be in a world where I can't listen to and enjoy Don't Stop Till You Get Enough ever again, it's that good.
Put this on last night. Didn't tell my wife what number four was on your list. I just said, you will know this within half a second. And you get that. And she was just like, had this smile that came across her face. It's really amazing to hear in the context of this list where Michael Jackson, like where his ideas were already just so dominant. And to think about the range that he's going to have from basically the late 1970s into It's called the early 90s. Don't Stop Till You Get Enough was released in July of 79 and hit the Billboard Hot 100 number one. I am guessing, I don't have it in front of me here, but I'm guessing that this was when it was on its decline, but still lingering on the top 100. Let's actually see. So the week prior, it had been 12. Here it's 4. It had been on the charts for 10 weeks. Let's see what happens here. It was number 2 on October 6th, and it reached number 1 the week of October 13th. So Don't Stop Till You Get Enough was the song, it seems like, of late summer, early fall, 1979. And listening to this, like, it just sounds like fall 1979 to me. And it's just wild to, like, think about the stretch he would have from 1979 to 1991 with Black or White, and, like, the cultural grasp that he would have over music and pop during this period in time. It's just fucking wild, isn't it? Like, how much changed culturally between 1979 and 1991, and Michael Jackson is, like, owning everything at that point.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't call the king of pop is a well-earned phrase. Yes. Unfortunately, every time you talk about Michael Jackson now, you got to discuss the other thing. But at least for a moment in 1979, he was unstoppable. So, wrapping up the top five, number five was Earth, Wind, and Fire, After the Love is Gone. After the Love is Gone. It's a ballad. It's you hear it on AM gold stations to this day. The second I heard it, I said, oh yeah, I know what this song is. Definitely heard this for my parents' car. Still hear it in cars. I know this album also had the big hit Boogie Wonderland, which, according to legend, I used to jump up and down in my jumper when my parents played it when I was like 2 years old. So, good on Boogie Wonderland. Earth, Wind, and Fire are a hell of a band. Almost kind of like tons of people on stage, horn section, almost kind of like P-Funk in a way. Probably best known from the eternally kind of annoying Bar Mitzvah song September, but pretty serious band.
Very serious band, and a song that sounds completely rooted in late 70s America. Listening to this, I definitely had heard this before. The Earth, Wind, and Fire greatest hits, as we talked about in Undermine Season 2, is played often during set break at Fish shows, and just a ballad that slaps.
Going forward, Brian, you were born on March 19th, 1985. A very different top five.
Yeah, this was another thing my wife and I were talking about, is how different the Billboard top 10 charts are now compared to when we were born, where there is a serious era-defining nature to the music that you heard when you were born in the 1970s, the late 70s, to the music I heard when I was born in the mid-1980s. Whereas now there's a lot of, like, amalgamation of styles, and what you, like, we looked at, my son was born in September of 2015, and we were looking at that versus, like, 2009. And while there's a lot of differences, there's also more similarities than what you would get now in terms of, or when what you would get when we were born in terms of what was successful over a 6 year period in time. So one additional thing I will say before I jump into the list, I listened to this last night, and so much makes sense. Like, my love now for gated drums and synthesizers and just big open vistas of choruses makes complete sense as I listen to this entire list, which begins with REO Speedwagon's Can't Fight This Feeling. Champagne Urbana's own REO Speedwagon, a band that I'm admittedly much more familiar with in name and pictures than in music. I'd obviously heard this song before, but it is a, as Dave mentioned, and I agree completely, it is a drugstore classic.
Yeah, this is the CVS Waiting for Your Prescription song to end all CVS Waiting for Your Prescription songs. It's just pristine, sad sack, unrequited love ballad. And that shit sold like hotcakes in 1985.
Yeah, and it's the type of stuff that, like, pretty much at any other point in my life, I would have been like, this is cheesy as all hell. Why aren't these guys just playing real drum set? Why is there so much like gloss everywhere? Why does everything sound so reverb induced? And now I just love it. So I listened to this multiple times last night and was like, this could have been the ballad on I Don't Live Here Anymore. It very easily could have been, and I would have loved it. Number two is one of the biggest songs of the 1980s, and a song that when I put it on, without telling my wife what I was doing, prompted her to ask, are you okay? And that is Living in a Material World. Madonna's Material Girl, a song that was probably the first Madonna song I remember hearing a couple years later. Fucking slaps, man.
Oh,
what
yeah.
What a bass line.
Great song. Great song. It's Madonna. She was her run of hits in the 80s is unassailable. It's a great song.
Yeah, I'm glad that we had Madonna and Michael Jackson on both of our lists because both just seem to like consume what it means and what it meant to release pop singles in the 1980s and 1970s.
She was basically flawless in the 80s. Early 90s, stumbled a bit with the erotica, bedtime stories like Dick Tracy era. And then, of course, Ray of Light, total fucking comeback in 98.
Absolutely incredible record.
Yeah.
So we move into number three, which is yet another one that I would not have appreciated until recently, and I absolutely loved it, which was Phil Collins's One More Night.
One more night. I can't wait forever.
I have you, and I have Matt Dwyer to thank for my love for and obsession with over the last year and a half of Genesis. I guess I also have Fish to thank for it, but you know, there was a long period in my life where I kind of pushed that influence aside and had very limited interest in getting into larger Genesis work, larger Peter Gabriel, larger Phil Collins. And now I'm just completely hooked and hearing Phil Collins at that point in the 1980s when his voice matched the aesthetics of the music behind him, matched the vibe of the song in such a perfect way that just screams spring of 1985.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the production aesthetics on One More Night feature quite heavily in our the thing we talked about last week. The latest War on Drugs record, the fourth song, I Don't Want to Wait. That's, God, that drum beat and the gatedness is about as Phil Collins as you can possibly get. So I know some people, they actually like No Jacket Required better than most 80s Genesis records. I wouldn't go that far. I don't agree with that. But, yeah, I mean, look, Phil Collins had 1985 in the Stranglehold.
The dude was at the top of his game. Like the era and the music he was making just matched itself perfectly, which goes fairly well into the number four song, which I also think I Don't Want to Wait sounds like 80s Don Henley, and Don Henley's compatriot in the Eagles, Glenn Frey, released The Heat Is On, which was on the...
Was that Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack?
It was on the Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack.
Okay.
An album, a movie, a mood that just screams the mid-1980s when we were like, hey, move to Miami, move to LA. These are the hot spots of America right now. Los Angeles in the 1980s is something I would have loved to have seen. Like just the lights and the palm trees just feels alive.
The Sunset Strip.
Yes.
Some rock shows at the Whiskey and the Troubadour. The higher the hair, the closer to God.
This is not that. This is very Heartland rock 1980s in the best way possible. I think the album cover, the single cover of Glenn Frey's, he's driving like a classic 50s convertible with like dice hanging from the rearview mirror. It's at that time in the 1980s where artists were saying, hey, we should look back. You know, Neil Young recorded a rockabilly album a couple of years earlier. Bruce Springsteen was driving around classic cars in I'm on Fire, and Glenn Frey singing The Heat Is On from the driver's seat in a white convertible. Just owned that era.
I don't know. Whenever I think of Glenn Frey, yeah, the two songs I think of are The Heat Is On and You Belong to the City, both of which known for their very, very 80s saxophone riffs. The Heat Is On is also great because it was the basis of that awesome late 90s SNL digital short with Will Ferrell and Ben Stiller and Jimmy Fallon, where Will Ferrell plays Glenn Frey, and it's you just have to go back and see it, but he basically says the H is O. So whenever whenever the heat pipes come on in my apartment in New York City, heat pipes, it's all or nothing. I always go to my wife, the H is O. She's like, oh yeah, I know. But yeah, definitely YouTube that. That's worth watching.
So great mid-80s jam.
Yeah.
We close out then with Julian Lennon's Too Late for Goodbyes, which I admittedly hadn't heard, and I followed the career of Sean Lennon far more than I have followed the career of Julian Lennon, even though Julian appeared to be in the mid-1980s. I think Sean was like a little kid, so it makes sense, but Julian appeared to be the one that was going to carry his dad's torch.
It couldn't have been easy being Julian Lennon, putting out your first record 4 years after your father's death.
It's a really tough mantle to try to claim. John Lennon's like there with, you know, Dylan, Neil Young, Springsteen as like the great American, great Western songwriters. Obviously, John Lennon is from England, but, you know, he embraced America in his later life, and to inherit that and try to create your own career with that hanging over you. I mean, I think the only person who's been really successful in that sort of matter is Jacob Dylan kind of inheriting what his dad did. I mean, Sean Lennon put out a great record in 2006 called, I'm blanking on the title now, but I really enjoyed that album when it came out.
I mean, the first three Julian Lennon records, in terms of like 80s, interesting 80s pop, actually are not bad at all. You'd be very surprised if you go back and listen to them. They haven't. Certainly the 80s production has aged them somewhat, but I mean, look, he was the son of John Lennon, and he still found a way to have like a top five like Billboard hit in 1985. He continued to make music even throughout the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. I noticed his most recent release is a cover of Karma Police with Nuno Bettencourt from Extreme featured on guitar, which strikes me as kind of sad and unnecessary that Julian Lennon has got to do that at this point in his career. But I listened to it. It basically just sounds like Radiohead's, like he's doing a karaoke version of Karma Police with a big Extreme guitar solo at the end of it. So if you can get past that, though, there's a surprising amount of goodies to be had in the first three Julian Lennon records if you want to do your own Julian Lennon deep dive.
It is pretty amazing. I'm just looking up Julian Lennon's Wikipedia page. He was born in 1963. He is almost 60 years old. He's almost lived 20 years longer than his father would live.
And, yeah, it was John Lennon's first wife. It was Cynthia.
It was Cynthia, yeah.
Yeah, Sean Lennon, that's like Yoko's kid.
Yeah, and I mean, by all accounts, John was a complete monster to his son and just kind of neglected him from a very early age and had absolutely zero interest in being a father. So has to be an incredibly hard life to grow up the offspring of someone that literally the entire world adores and have them be your dad who just didn't care about you. And because they didn't care about you, was able to focus on their own career and their own life in a way that completely neglected you. So amazing that he was able to have the kind of chart success that he did, even 4 years after his dad's passing. The one thing I will add, just as we close out this segment, I was texting with my parents last night, and I was telling them that we were doing this, and I said, if you guys want to listen to the songs that were famous when I was being born. And I joked, you know, these are the songs that mom was listening to in the hospital when she was going through labor. And my mom immediately responded and said, I didn't listen to any of those songs in the hospital. I listened to Dire Straits' self-titled record. I listened to Blood on the Tracks by Bob Dylan, and I listened to U2's The Unforgettable Fire. And I just texted back, this explains everything.
Mrs. Brinkman, too cool for the heat is on and can't fight this feeling. I get it. You know.
If my mom liked going to concerts, which she hates. She hates large groups of people. She hates lots of noise. She hates chaos. She hates discomfort. Concerts are not her thing. She used to go to a lot. But if she loved going to concerts, I would see a concert with my mom at least once a month if I could. My dad and I, we have an incredible relationship about music, but even my dad would admit it. It's my mom that brings Springsteen to the table, that brought U2 to the table, that brought Dire Straits to the table, that brings Dylan to the table. My mom is the musical warhorse in our family, and it explains everything. She had to have been listening to Buckets of Rain as I was being born.
And yet, your mom brings so much to the table. Were it not for Jim Brinkman, we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
This is very true. It's very true. All right, thank you for hanging with us as we did a journey through the past. It's a Neil Young reference. We are going to talk about new albums that we recommend you listen to. We are coming to a time of the year where our top 5, top 10, top 20, top 30, I don't know how many you're going to have this year, Dave. I'm probably going to have somewhere between 40 and 50 favorite albums of the year, but we're coming to a point at the end of the year where lots of fascinating albums are about to drop while we're trying to organize our thoughts around what 2021 meant to us. And in that spirit, what is the record that you recommend right now?
So I'm going to talk about a record by an artist named Marissa Nadler. And the album is called The Path of the Clouds. And it was released on the Sacred Bones label, as of all of her records. This is an artist, she's been doing this for about 20 years. She has actually several records up to this point. And Marissa Nadler has kind of had her own lane in sort of, I would say, somewhat gothic, ethereal, layered folk music. I mean, that's sort of been her thing in the sense that every photo you see of her, she's wearing black. It's definitely elements of shoegaze, elements of symphonic sound, elements of folk, you know, all kind of very much in the woods, so to speak. And she has a lot of records, most of which I think are degrees of good to very good, but her new one kind of grabbed me in a way that her prior ones haven't in quite a while. I mean, it helps that I know she's based out of Boston. I think her and her husband moved to Nashville and she started to make this record. It was largely made during the pandemic when she had, you know, a lot of time to be indoors and write. I think she even kind of taught herself piano during the pandemic because normally she's mostly known as a guitarist and a vocalist. But she kind of drafted almost what seems like an all-star cast of goth musicians for this record. I know that Mary Lattimore chips in on a harp on, I think, 3 different songs. The bass player from the Cocteau Twins is here. The musician Emma Ruth Rundle, who kind of pulls bark off the same tree as Marissa Nadler. She's also here, also recently put out a very good new album of her own. And really, the songwriting, I think what she did is she took a lot of inspiration from watching episodes of Unsolved Mysteries. A lot of these songs, they kind of pull from nonfiction tales. They can almost be considered murder ballads, and it's a very symphonic sound. It's a very dense sound. There's certainly some elements of shoegaze. It kind of reminds me a lot of the excellent album from Way's Blood, which came out last year, which we liked a whole lot. But really, this is also getting a sense of kind of like some Boys for Pele era, Tori Amos. Sort of like an artist who I was always aware of and enjoyed without really loving, but kind of the quality of this record makes you really think I've got to take a bigger stab at going back to her discography and giving it a mine, because this is pretty great stuff. So Marissa Nadler, The Path to the Clouds. Let's listen to the title track, the second song on the record.
I'm going to recommend a record by a band that I absolutely love, but admittedly was unaware that they had released a new record until just the evening before we recorded this, when Dave texted me and said, "This is your wheelhouse." And I was like, "Oh my God, new Suss." Suss is in all caps, S-U-S-S, is a New York City-based quartet. They play, wait for it, ambient country drone jams.
The most ambient country drone jams.
The most. And this record, man, I almost want to step back in time, because this record came out on October 22nd, 2021, a couple weeks back, which listeners of this pod will know, I was in Phoenix, Arizona on October 22nd, 2021, about to take a drive from Phoenix to San Diego. This record, it's an EP, but it's a fantastic EP worth listening to, called Night Suite, was written about a drive through the night on the U.S. Route 66 between Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Los Angeles, California, also known as the Purple Heart Highway. I'm just going to read a bit from their description here in Bandcamp, because it says it better than I ever could. On that last leg of the Great American Journey, you feel the melancholy, the strain, and the high you get from being awake too long. It's the endless horizon, the sodium arc lights of a truck stop, the slap of windshield wipers, the all-night talk radio, the rumble of the tires on the road, and the smell of burnt coffee before the first light of dawn. The EP is a sonic roadmap pointing the way from the dark of the night to a new dawn. In 2020, Suss longed for a change of sort of scenery, an escape, a trip through an uncharted landscape. As the fathers of the ambient country sound, the band built the five tracks of Night Suite with their unique combination of classic Americana instrumentation, pedal steel, national guitar, harmonica, and fiddle, interwoven with loops and synthesizers. And man, it's all that. I would have killed for this record on that drive between Phoenix and San Diego. I am glad for it, and I'm grateful for it now, because that drive that I took, man, it was one of my favorite drives I've ever taken in my entire life. It was with our good buddy Ben Greenfield. We had killer music, the scenery driving through southwestern Arizona into southeastern California, kind of hugging the U.S.-Mexico border. It's one of my favorite I've ever taken. We were driving in a convertible, completely unexpected, between a very solid fish show in Phoenix on the way to probably the best fish show I will ever see in Chula Vista on October 23rd. And hearing this record now, it just takes me back to it immediately in my top album list of 2021. And I just want to add one additional thing. Days after the tracks were completed, Suss lost one of their original members, the synthesizer and filmmaker Gary Lib. The loss, as they note, adds a new personal resonance to the music, as he had such a huge role in creating this. So really personal record for the band, while also tapping into that just vibe of driving through kind of distant America, Americana. I don't know, man. It's something else. And this record just hit a nerve for me, and I'm excited for everyone to listen to it. So we're going to listen to the first track off of it, Gallup, New Mexico, which just sounds and feels like what you want this record to be. And I also will advocate for the album artwork from Spotify, which I typically despise, but the album artwork just shows the location of wherever they've written these songs in kind of an evening to morning drive through stoplights and small towns and main streets. And man, it gets you. So let's listen to Gallup, New Mexico off of Suss's Night Sweet EP.
All right, Brian, thank you for playing us that Suss. I agree. They are kind of the champions of the ambient country sound, that pedal steel, the longing of the pedal steel. And at this point, if you've gotten this far with us, as always, we appreciate it. We celebrate you. We see you. And thank you very much for hanging with us once again on The Drop.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.